3, 2, 1.
And it seems to me that people are tired of the constant turmoil in local government. So after considerable thought and discussion, I have decided to inform the Alaska Public Offices Commission of my intent to file for the position of mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And I hope with...
There were more supporters than reporters at the news conference Wednesday when Jim Sampson announced his political plans. The former labor commissioner under Governor Steve Cooper, Sampson says he'll draw on his administrative experience if elected mayor. Sampson joins a field of 5 borough assembly members who also want the job. He's never held a local office, but thinks that's a good thing since he'll have a fresh perspective.
I have seen a change in tone in the community. You see that, you can feel that, at least I do. And you're reading that, and I think that's a positive change in the community. Plus, I think that people want to see others in the community that are not on the assembly. So perhaps with me throwing my hat in a ring, maybe you'll see some others follow.
Sampson says he's not interested in sitting on the assembly since he's more comfortable on the management rather than the legislative side of things. As labor commissioner, he managed and developed a $52 million budget and oversaw labor and management issues. Since he's not working now, the tall 40-year-old Fairbanks resident says he'll have plenty of time and energy to campaign.
We're going to see a lot of people. I'm going to work hard, and I've talked to a lot of people already. I'm going to go to Chattanooga, to Two Rivers, to Salcha. Might even put my boat in the river and go up the river once. But I'm going to see a lot of people. I'm going to meet a lot of groups. We're going to put a good campaign together.
Sampson is married and has 2 children. His campaign chairperson will be former State Attorney General Grace Scheibel. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
There's never, ever been an instance that anybody can ever remember, either recorded officially or unofficially, of a seal that forgets to breathe when it's asleep or even underwater asleep. We now have evidence that we're getting ready to submit right now to Science Magazine showing that the seals can sleep underwater and make their way to the surface and breathe and go back down underwater and stay asleep the whole time. Human babies usually go through very short periods of apnea, which is a fancy term for breath holding, routinely while they're sleeping. And they just don't control the heart rate very well during those periods, just like young seals don't. But the difference is that seals develop their way right out of this, and that ultimately the seals become very good breath holders, even as pups. And during that time, when they are holding their breath, their heart rate is very, very stable and very, very well controlled. There are a whole variety of things that they scan infants for to find out if they perhaps might be at risk for SIDS. But typically what they do is they monitor the heart rate only while the child is breathing. And when it goes through these little short periods of breath holding, they just sort of toss that information. It's not particularly relevant. What we're thinking is that information may be extremely relevant. And so in the process of where they're monitoring children that they sort of suspect anyway, and or they're just doing a study where they may go out and monitor 500 children or all the children born in Fairbanks this year or something to try to predict who might be and who might not be at risk for SIDS, that if they are at all like seal pups, that we're hoping that we might be able to come up with a better risk assessment method, and that if they can compare what the heart rate is like when the children are breath holding, if it's nice and stable and doing what it should versus noisy, then we might hope that might be a better method for predicting which infants might be at risk.
And I'll do my part.
So how are you going to walk out there right now? We could get some shots, sort of wide shots of you guys.
Gathering footage for a television program isn't the glamorous job people might imagine. The Travel Channel's 3-person video crew spent 10 days in Alaska, carrying around lots of heavy equipment, rushing to meet a tight schedule, and stopping to shoot and reshoot scenes that may or may not end up in the final production.
I want to get a close-up of him moving the plant aside so you can see him revealing strawberry. There's some over there.
One stop during their final day in the state was at Ed and Aggie Bostrom's experimental farm, North Pole Acres. Travel Channel producer Susan Hyman says they want to show a little about the people of the state.
I personally really enjoy seeing the native aspects of places that we visit, even if it doesn't mean necessarily American Indian or Eskimo, just the people that have shaped a place, that have really shaped a place. Those are the type of people that really add flavor to an area. And I think what Pat is doing is fantastic too, because she takes you to meet people. She actually takes you out to meet locals that you'd absolutely have no way of meeting.
They got that by booking a tour with Van Gogh, a business started by Pat Walsh that takes visitors to meet Alaska's people, not necessarily its places. Walsh sets a schedule specifically for the visitor. On this particular day, there were some things that had to be dropped because of time, but the Travel Channel crew taped a walking tour of downtown Fairbanks, stopped at the home of dog mushers Shannon and Kurt Earhart, and took a boat ride to Howard Luke's camp on the Tanana River. They got to hear some stories from the Athabaskan elder, saw where he's building his community center, and learned how natives live off the land. Luke also holds a spirit camp each August for his people to come together.
We all have problems, you know. Sometimes we get in a fight or something like that, you know, and we feel sorry for it. Cause a lot of us is carrying that stuff with us, you know. Mm-hmm. We're carrying it with us. And it's bothering us all the time. It's bothering us all the time. So that's what the spirit camp is for, you know. We talk about our problems and we talk to each other, and pretty quick, yeah, we feel bad about each other, you know. And people get up there and they put your hand on each other, you know, and it just draws right out. You can just feel it. I mean, it just comes right out of you.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Can we have you take people over here and talk about your community center that you're putting together? Mm-hmm.
Rewalking a certain path for the camera's benefit, fighting off mosquitoes while walking through Luke's camp, and taping a fish wheel for hours in the hope you'll get a shot of it catching a fish, makes for a long day. Producer Susan Hyman says the footage will be used for a half-hour program called American Road Trips, detailing a trip from Seward to Fairbanks.
We give them an idea of a scenic route that they could possibly take and just point out some of the things that they should see along the way and do. And the chances of them meeting all of the people that we interview aren't likely. You know, we interview artists and things, and, you know, they might not have accessibility, but at least it gives them an idea of the kind of people that live in a place, some of the more colorful characters that represent a place, so that they have more of a feel for an area.
The Travel Channel is a 24-hour cable television channel. It's not available in Fairbanks, but it is in Anchorage. After Susan Hyman puts the show together at the New York Production Center, it should first air sometime in late September. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Closing the co-op, I sure gonna miss it. It's gonna be nobody around. Everything gonna be just like it's down the drain, like everything else. And
they first started. This was just a very small store, and the owner came up here, was a pharmacist, had no money at all, and a few friends put in a little bit of money, so that was where the cooperative name came from. It was one of the first concrete and steel stressed buildings in the interior, built by Cap Lathrop.
I like to go over there and, you know, sit down and have something to, you know, sit down and drink coffee or have something to eat or something, you know. But now I can come down here and go see nothing.
The co-op closes, the restaurant closes. They keep saying the first of the month, every month, so I don't know if it's... When I started working here, it's only supposed to be for 2 weeks, and I've been here for 2 months.
Soda fountains are a thing of the past. You don't see them anymore. We came in today knowing that this will probably be the last time we'll have a chance to be here.
We don't make our own decisions here. The owner lives in Seattle, Washington, and he was here not long ago, and thought we should continue to stay open for a little while.
People talking in the newspaper and the media getting hold of different things. They were going to close last January, they were going to close this spring, they're going to close by the 1st of June. The restaurant's been holding up. The last 30 days we've noticed a decrease in revenue.
I am not really into sentimentality over 1950 buildings. You know, if they're 1850 buildings in Taos, New Mexico or something, then I see historic value, but just old buildings, they're just old buildings to me. And this has run its time. It's been here 61 years. They had a good run for their money. It's a supported a lot of people for a long time.
Well, I think Bill has to go further than just the front of the co-op to the upstairs of the co-op to the basement of the co-op to get any more feeling out of it. But when you live there, breathe there, eat there, and work there, I mean, I guess you got different feelings about it. I think when he retires, he's just going to take the key with him.
As a kid, we used to walk down across the bridge, and we always stopped in the co-op to have our cherry Coke at the counter. If you wanted to get a, you know, tube of mascara or a new bottle of perfume, you always went to the co-op because they had the biggest makeup cosmetic section going.
We used to have like four or five in the cosmetics, and these were full-grown adult women who were schooled in cosmetics and wore nice dresses and costume jewelry and really knew what they were doing. And now about the time we get anything for the cosmetics is somebody has a black eye. Some girl has a black eye and wants some kind of makeup to cover it.
And I didn't realize how empty the toy department was until you kind of walk in and look around, and just lots of things have been sold at this point.
Well, there was a big toy store upstairs, so we liked that. And yeah, we cut through co-op to warm up through all the, and across the street was Cooper's Hardware, and you just had your route through town where you could get warm every other block or something like that, and co-op was one.
I heard rumor that the Lutheran's Ladies Aid Society is going to turn this into a bingo parlor. I don't know.
It's all kinds of people, and you can see that they come there because they know they're going to see somebody there that they know. They're not going to be alone there. A lot of people don't want to go just sit somewhere by themselves and have lunch. If they're going to go out to lunch and don't have nobody to go with, go to the co-op, you'll have lunch with somebody.
3, 2, 1. Dr. Michael Castellini has studied seals for more than a decade. While looking at how diving seals can hold their breath for such a long time, he learned that when seals sleep, they hold their breath. Babies that die from SIDS somehow stop breathing in their sleep. Castellini says that's not the case with seals.
There's never, ever been an instance that anybody can ever remember, either recorded officially or unofficially, of a seal that forgets to breathe when it's asleep, or even underwater asleep. We now have evidence that we're getting ready to submit right now to Science Magazine showing that the seals can sleep underwater and make their way to the surface and breathe and go back down underwater and stay asleep the whole time.
What surprised Castellini last year, though, was finding that apparently when seal pups are quite young, they have poor control of their heart rate and respiratory system. The same is true for babies at risk for sudden infant death syndrome. But the seal pups eventually learn to hold their breath for as long as 15 minutes at a time, unlike humans.
Human babies usually go through very short periods of apnea, which is a fancy term for breath holding, routinely while they're sleeping. And they just don't control the heart rate very well during those periods, just like young seals don't. But the difference is that seals develop their way right out of this, and that ultimately the seals become very good breath holders, even as pups. And during that time, when they are holding their breath, their heart rate is very, very stable and very, very well controlled.
Castellini is hoping to get funding from the National Institute of Health to study seal pups and their breath holding capabilities. If they can predict the ability of pups to hold their breath, he thinks it's possible to better predict that ability in humans.
There are a whole variety of things that they scan infants for to find out if they perhaps might be at risk for SIDS. But typically what they do is they monitor the heart rate only while the child is breathing. And when they go through these little short periods of breath holding, they just sort of toss that information. It's not particularly relevant. What we're thinking is that that information may be extremely relevant. And so in the process of where they're monitoring children that they sort of suspect anyway, to try to predict who might be and who might not be at risk for SIDS, that if they are at all like seal pups, that we're hoping that we might be able to come up with a better risk assessment method.
Castellini says that even without funding from the National Institute of Health, they did get some money from the American Heart Association, so a study will be done. He hopes to have a better idea of a link between seals and SIDS sometime next year. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. Three, two, one.
In the last couple weeks, this assembly has been made to look like pretty big idiots. Not that we haven't done our share of doing that to ourselves, but this particular case has bothered me.
Assemblymember Donna Gilbert set the stage as last night's assembly meeting was winding down. She was the first to unload her concerns over criticism directed at the assembly about its July 25th meeting. That's when the assembly offered to buy the borough administration building in order to settle a lawsuit with the building's owner, Dick Fisher. The assembly wanted to pay Fisher $4 million over the next 4 years to buy the building, but refused to make the offer public, even though it was going to put it in a letter the next day and send it to the man who had taken them to court. In retrospect, Assemblymember John Davies was one who agreed that it should have been discussed in public.
I think that we made a mistake and we should learn from that mistake. Having said that, however, I think that the light in which this thing was put, I think were hysterical and overblown. I don't believe that there was an intent to, in fact, make a decision out of the public eye.
Assembly members aren't happy about the media coverage the issue got, but they're even more unhappy with the legal advice they got from then-borough attorney Gene Hardy, who could make a convenient scapegoat since he quit working for the borough the day after that meeting. Assemblywoman Donna Gilbert says they were simply keeping the offer quiet on his advice.
I do not believe that this assembly should have been held up to the ridicule that they were for following legal advice from a very high-paid attorney in this borough that is supposed to be our legal leader.
The borough's current attorney, Mark Andrews, told the assembly last night that the offer should have been made in public, while any of the risks involved could have been brought up in the private session. But Andrews still maintains that letters involved in the negotiations should be kept confidential, even though Fisher rejected the borough's offer. Individual assembly members have authorized their release to the media, and that's why Assemblymember Hank Bartow says all the details surrounding what he calls Fishergate should now be out in the open.
The spirit and intent of the confidentiality of that entire session has been breached time and time again, and therefore I would move that my colleagues at this time override the concerns of our attorneys and make public the entire contents of that meeting.
But while assembly members say they want it all out in the open, they decided to wait a week before voting on releasing it all on the advice of their attorney so he can review the tape and make sure its release won't give Fisher's attorney something he can use against the borough in court. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Fairbanks firefighters have watched their numbers diminish over the last few years as the city tightened its belt. In the mid-1980s, there were as many as 16 firefighters on duty at a given time. Today, with 29 firefighters on the city payroll, staffing levels can be as low as 6 per shift. Up until now, firefighters have been putting in overtime to keep staffing levels up as much as possible, but the city says it cannot pay the overtime anymore. So at the beginning of this month, the city decided to restrict firefighters' leave time, so only one could be gone per shift. That violates the union contract, which allows as many as 3 firefighters on leave at a time. But Fairbanks Mayor Wayne Nelson says management had to do something to bring costs in line. Nelson accuses the firefighters of only being concerned about losing their overtime pay.
It is not the voting public or even the administration that's causing the problem. It is the blatant greed and hunger for overtime that makes this impossible. In the public employee retirement system, their retirement base is based on their 3 most productive concurrent years or current years. And I hate to say it, but I think that's what they're shooting for.
Nelson says it's not firefighters' salaries he has a problem with. It's just the overtime. More than $200,000 has been spent on their overtime this year, and Nelson says most of that time was put in at the station, not out fighting fires. He says since the change was implemented, firefighters had fewer than 90 hours of overtime in the first half of August, compared to more than 750 hours during the month of July. But longtime firefighter Barry Haight says overtime isn't the point. Having enough firefighters to do the job is.
The appropriate number of people would be approximately 3 times the number on each shift that we actually do have. Overtime up until now has been required by management to continue a vague semblance of a proper firefighting force. We now are not pushing for the overtime, we're pushing for the appropriate number of people to be on duty to run the ambulance, to operate the fire engines, and serve all the emergencies that we're called upon. And in this instance, it takes the overtime.
One thing that Haight says the city seems to forget is what firefighters gave up over the last few years of their contract. They made concessions that amounted to more than $600,000. And Haight says staffing hasn't been anywhere near recognized national standards for years.
It's up to the council to provide for the staffing and for the money. They like to use the phrase their hands are tied, but they are not. And they are the ones in control of the city and who have the responsibility to the public and to the employees. It looks to me like they've abrogated that responsibility.
Haight and Nelson agree that the fire department staffing level isn't what it should be, but Nelson says the public needs to see that the city is at least trying to save money before voters will support paying more for city services. Nelson feels that shift in public sentiment is right around the corner.
But until we turn the corner with the overtime and some of these outrageous expenditures, the voting public is never, as they've shown in the past, going to agree to giving the city more revenues to do things. And frankly, I don't blame them.
Firefighters and the city are in the midst of negotiating a new contract. As to the lawsuit, the city has a few more weeks to respond to the complaint, but the city maintains the issue should be settled through the grievance procedure rather than in court. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Rather than in court. Three, two, one. The last year hasn't been an especially good one for social service agencies. Last summer, they started thinking about how to survive on less state money when then-Governor Steve Cooper cut their block grant funds. This summer, they're facing the reality that under the Hickel administration, state funding will be less than plentiful. Most all of them are planning some way of coping, though. The new commander for the Salvation Army in Fairbanks, Captain Preston Ryder, says the emergency shelter will reopen November 1st, even with only 6 months' worth of funding. Ryder says it may become more of a transitional housing place than an emergency shelter, but it will be open and they'll try to raise the money to keep it open. Samantha Castle at the Fairbanks Food Bank has already had a little bit of good luck. After writing many grant proposals and facing a loss of more than $20,000 in block grant money, Castle says a grant came through from the Hearst Foundation for $25,000, so this year they'll do okay. The Resource Center for Parents and Children was particularly hard hit, though. It lost nearly 40% of its state funding, not just through the block grant. A large grant was lost when the State Office of Prevention was eliminated. The Resource Center's director, Diane Worley, says some of the center's early intervention programs will be all right. It's the prevention programs that were hit hardest by the $200,000 cut.
When you combine losing the Office of Prevention money with almost half of our community education money, the priority that we are losing is our prevention efforts. And that's who we are. That's who the Resource Center is. We are a prevention agency. Our goal is to provide services to the whole community, to help people give people the skills, the information, to empower families to be healthy and strong so that they never get to a point of becoming where they have to go to the Division of Family and Youth Services. These are the monies we're losing, and for me that is the hardest thing to deal with in all of the cuts that we're having. It's not so much the cuts. We do not mind taking a fair share of cuts. Our agency is taking a larger percentage of cuts because we are a prevention agency. Prevention is not a priority.
Worley says what that means is change for her organization, not a change in what they do, but how they do it. They'll have to start collecting fees for some things that were free before, and they may not be able to provide services to as many people as they'd like. But Worley says they don't want to eliminate anything.
So what we're going to try to do is not to change our services too much, but to try to reduce the services that we're offering, to not be able to serve as many people. We also, like every other agency in town, are going to be looking for more support from the community, through fundraisers, through donations, and through other funding sources, private foundations, corporations. You know, if we want to maintain the services that we offer, I think it's apparent that we are not going to get support for prevention and education programming for the next few years.
And the Resource Center isn't alone in trying to see just how much more money it can get from the community. Breadline, Big Brother Big Sister, and Women in Crisis Counseling all plan more local fundraising this year. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. On Three, two, one. Assembly members didn't have anything good to say about a privacy and public information ordinance proposed by Assemblyman Hank Bartos. Bartos wanted it postponed so it could be improved on, but Assemblywoman Donna Gilbert wasn't sure time was going to make a bad ordinance better.
So could you explain the problem with this to us, sir, as to why it should be postponed rather than just voted down?
That's your opinion, is that you should vote it down, and you're welcome to do that. I think it needs more work, and that we are in need of a document of this nature.
But others on the Assembly felt that the ordinance needs a lot of work, and instead of postponing it, they voted it down. They did so after hearing two citizens complain about the Assembly's executive session last month, when Assembly members took a vote after a closed-door session, but didn't specify what they were voting on. Later, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner learned that they were voting to make an offer to buy the borough office building. North Pole resident Betty Rollins told the Assembly buying the building isn't a good idea, and not discussing the offer in public wasn't either.
I don't know if you really tried to go in and do something behind somebody's back, but boy, it sure came out that way, and I am very, very unhappy about it.
The offer to buy the building was rejected by the owner, Dick Fisher, who is suing the borough for allegedly violating its lease with him. Assemblymember John Davies pointed out to Betty Rollins that even if the offer had been accepted, the Assembly would still have to appropriate the money to buy the building. But Rollins still questioned Davies about the action.
If he had already accepted that offer, can you get out of it?
Yes. That's what I'm saying. The offer would be contingent upon public approval.
Was that the way it was offered?
Yes.
But Davies hadn't seen the letter extending the settlement offer, and the offer itself was never discussed in public. Assembly members say their vote authorized the borough attorney to offer Fisher the next 3 years' lease payments as purchase payments. At the end of the lease, the borough would pay him $1.8 million. That would amount to more than $4 million, and the building would be theirs. Assemblymember Bonnie Williams says the vote didn't bind the Assembly, since spending the money would have to be addressed later if Fisher accepted the deal, but she hasn't seen the offer in writing either.
Have I seen the letter? No. We had a discussion in executive session about a whole lot of different litigation issues, all revolving around Mr. Fisher, but not all necessarily revolving around this building. This motion to buy this building was only one of the instructions. I have not seen what the attorney's office responded. I assume that they followed our instructions.
The borough attorney maintains the letter extending the offer to Fisher is confidential, so he hasn't released it to the media. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Borough voters approved the tax cap in 1987 and reauthorized it in 1989. Both times, the tax cap question made it on the ballot through the initiative process, which shields it from being changed for 2 years. Now the effort to set a limit on the borough's maximum tax revenues is being done by ordinance, and the acting borough attorney isn't so sure it will have the same effect. The ordinance was drafted by Peter Ashenbrenner, who worked on the original tax cap, and he told the Assembly last night that not going through the initiative process was a little different approach.
This proposal that you have before you today contains all of the elements required to exactly track the language of state law, except that the Assembly has not required or waited, if you will, until a group went out and brought in the language signed by the number of voters required under state law.
But Acting Borough Attorney Mark Andrews told the Assembly that without coming through the initiative process, the tax cap could be questioned.
I do not think that this ordinance will produce a binding tax cap, binding for 2 years. An initiative election will bind the borough for 2 years. This is not an initiative election. I am concerned for the difference between what the yes vote is said to mean and the true legal effect of a yes vote.
Under the tax cap ordinance, a yes vote by voters would mean the cap remains and the borough cannot change it. A no vote also means the tax cap remains in effect, but the borough would be able to repeal or change it beginning in October. Assemblymember John Davies tried to change that in order to make it more clear.
I think that that issue is a complicated issue and that, in fact, the voters don't understand that. And I think that what would be good to be on, I expect that the thing's going to be approved, incidentally, but I think that what should be on the ballot is an up and down vote on the tax cap. And that if a voter votes no, he should be voting against the tax cap.
Davies proposed having a no vote mean that the tax cap would be repealed, a point that Harold Gillum agreed with, noting that giving the borough the power to change it is actually a repeal. But Donna Gilbert, who led the initiatives in previous years and decided to try a less costly method this year, didn't want the document changed.
And this is a well-written document. This was changed. The voters will understand. I am not going to be part of destroying the integrity of this tax cap.
The Assembly agreed on a 7-2 vote to submit the question to voters the way Gilbert wanted it submitted. John Davies and Don Lowell opposed it. Gilbert says she is concerned now about using this approach instead of the initiative process because of the questions that were raised last night, but says the majority of voters support the tax cap and expects the Assembly to take notice of that. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one.
Don't ignore us, it's not right. Civil now, avoid a strike. Don't ignore us, it's not right.
Picket signs greeted school board members Tuesday night. Members of the Education Support Staff Association, or ESSA, walked along the street in front of Old University Park School to show their support for a new contract. Negotiations between the school district and ESSA were suspended over the summer. ESSA President Susan Annis says now they're ready to get back to the bargaining table and get a contract.
This is hopefully a real demonstration of unity and solidarity and demonstration of the fact that we want to get a contract before school starts. We're doing everything we can do to avoid a strike is what we're trying to do. It's just, it's devastating for everyone. We want to get back in the schools and, you know, help the teachers teach, you know, help the administration, you know, provide the clerical and technical support to get the job done and get the kids back in school and get on with education.
The Education Support Staff Association's 500 members are the secretaries, teachers, aides, food service workers, library assistants, and maintenance workers that help keep the schools running. Dave Jones is now the school district's negotiator since Jim Mullen left. Jones says money remains a big issue. He says the last offer from the school board called for ESSA employees to get a stipend and what's known as a pay step increase for all but some job classifications. ESSA members want a 1% pay raise in addition to the step increase for employees. Jones says he's not sure just how close an agreement might be.
It's really tough to tell. That'll be difficult for me to assess until we get to the table and see just how strong the feelings are on both sides. And I suppose once I go into executive session, I'll get a good feel for that.
Jones met with the school board in a closed-door session last night to talk about the district's position. He planned to call ESSA members today to see when the two sides can get together and start negotiating again. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Well, I think that they did think about it and put some hard thought in. I know that each of the council members were probably lobbied very extensively by several different groups during the day today and last week, and apparently they were persuasive.
And I believe what we're doing here
3-2-1. Three ordinances that could have added at least $1.5 million to city coffers never even made it to the discussion stage. If approved by the council, voters would have been given the choice in October to increase the hotel-motel tax and institute a cigarette tax and a city tax on pull tab winnings. But no council member even made a motion to consider the tax proposals, so they weren't even debated. Mayor Wayne Nelson says he was surprised at first, but agreed with council members who didn't even see the point of rehashing old arguments.
The councilman individually figured that it didn't have a real chance of passing, and that there was no sense subjecting the public and to sit through that many hours of testimony for something that didn't have a chance anyway.
Later in the meeting, a few citizens commended the council on their inaction, saying it would have been ill-advised to ask voters to approve the new taxes. They were first proposed last month by City Councilman Bill Wally the night before he died. The City Council has now put to rest the idea of new taxes as well. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Sometimes it's necessary to withhold information to do that. I and most of my people in the assembly do not want, you know, to harm the public in any way. So therefore, we have these mechanisms which are provided for by law that we can withhold certain information. And when it's in the public's best interest to do, my colleagues choose to do that. There has been no guidelines, no written guidelines for this assembly to utilize in determining other than, you know, good judgment. And this puts things in writing so that if somebody violates the guidelines, then we can say you specifically violated this chapter and verse, and therefore you're liable for censure or whatever means the assembly wishes to take.
We were expecting 14 students, ages 14 to 17, and four teachers from Yakutsk on Sunday. They were supposed to arrive on the Aeroflot flight from Khabarovsk, but they didn't arrive. And we're not sure at this point what the problem is. At first, we speculated that they may have had visa problems, but then the news of Gorbachev's overturn had reached us, and we don't know whether that has some effect on it or not. We're hoping that they come in this Sunday on the 25th, but as I say, we're going to have our fingers crossed.
Up here for the past 3 years.
Okay, what this would do would be provide a bus service in cooperation with the military at Fort Wainwright, funded by them, that would also go out to North Pole and provide some bus service to the people at North Pole and sort of in a triangle from Fort Wainwright, North Pole, Fairbanks to Fort Wainwright. It allows us to provide a little more bus service for our residents and bus service for the military, with the military picking up most of the out-of-pocket costs for it.
Three, two, one. Children are not only learning about where Creamer's residents live, they're also learning about the inhabitants. Birds and animals, bugs and soils are also on the list of things to get in touch with at Camp Habitat. The camps were organized by Susan Gray Stoltz, who got ideas and suggestions from the Alaska Center for the Environment, which has been holding similar programs for a few years. Her goal is to get the kids familiar with their own backyard and teach them respect for nature. Stoltz says the days are hectic, but the kids are learning a lot.
At the end of the day, we sit down and we go around the circle and everyone shares one thing that they learned or they saw or they did that day. And we have an I Spy chart. And early in the week, it's slowly a few things go down on the I Spy chart. But by the end of the week, on the last full day on our overnight, we fill the whole back side of this thing in one day with all the things that we see. There, it shows an increase in their sense of observation And they are just, it's exciting to be around them because they really bring you down to look at closely and take time and observe and soak it all up. Our day starts off with a circle, with a morning circle, and we usually do a few songs. And we do the weather report, which is one of the first things you have to do before you go outside, is check out the weather and know what to bring along, you know, whether or not you need to wear your rubber boots or whether or not you need to wear your raincoat. So that's how we start our day. We do a morning bird count. When the kids come here to Kramer's, they scout around, they grab a pair of binoculars, and they see how many birds they can count and how many different kinds of birds they can see in the morning before we start our program. Then we are off and going all day long, it seems like, from activity to activity.
The field has different kind of bugs and critters that live there. The forest have different kind of critters that live there. So they'll be setting up bug traps in three different areas. Is three you're doing?
Four, I think.
Four bug traps. So if you want to go with Dr. Bugs, that is one option. That's option number one.
It was slightly wet, windy, and a little chilly during last week's camp, but that didn't slow down the 9 and 10-year-olds who signed up for the final Camp Habitat experience. Three different groups, who chose to call themselves the Pack, the Wild Things, and the Radberries, explored the fields and trees through the refuge. One of the group leaders was Jack Fontanella, also known as Dr. Bug.
They can get in here.
Make holes? Why?
Oh, there's plenty of holes right there.
What do they do? They crawl in or fly in.
They crawl in or fly in or however they get in.
Bugs.
And we'll see in 2 days. We'll come back in 2 days.
Then they don't know how to get out.
And see what we caught.
It has been so much fun. It's just been a great success. As far as I can see, the kids are exhausted at the end of the day. They're filthy dirty, so it shows me that they've had a lot of fun and they've gotten out in nature. And it's been real exciting to me. And I think next year we can make some changes. It's been a learning experience.
Let's go this way.
Where's the goose pond?
Camp Habitat was sponsored by the Friends of Kramer's Field and the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Assembly members passed their resolution based on rumors. Some jobs have already been transferred out of Fairbanks, and Assemblyman John Davies says the concern is that it might be a trend.
We characterize some of this information as rumor because it's just that. But there is, in fact, a lot of discussion going on in the administration about various ways to streamline state government. One of those ways to streamline government, it's kind of a standard knee-jerk reaction, is to consolidate things. And there appears to be a trend toward consolidating things in Anchorage. To the extent that that trend is real, it's a very big concern to those of us in the interior here. We don't believe that you can, you know, save money necessarily and provide good service by putting all the government bureaucrats who're supposed to provide the service in one place.
The resolution passed by the Assembly specifically mentions a couple of rumors that there will be transfers from the Department of Corrections and that the Department of Natural Resources plans to move the Division of Geophysical and Geological Survey out of Fairbanks. The Assembly is concerned about rumors of the loss of close to 200 jobs through consolidation, transfers, attrition, or layoffs. Those rumors came as a surprise to the governor's spokeswoman, Leola Weimer. She checked them out.
I've talked to both the Commissioner of Correction, Commissioner Hames, and to Commissioner Hines, Office Commission of Department of Natural Resources, and both of them confirmed that they have no plans and have issued no notices of any state jobs to be lost in Fairbanks. That is simply a rumor, and there's no truth in it. Corrections, if anything, is understaffed in Fairbanks, and as far as Department of Natural Resources go, there has been no notices or any decisions made as far as the Geophysical and Geological Institute moving that to any other place other than Fairbanks, where it is now.
The governor has said he'd like most job losses to come through attrition, but Weimer says Hickle has asked all his commissioners to see how things can be done most efficiently. There have been some consolidations and layoffs throughout the state, not just in Fairbanks. Jobs here may have been transferred out, but Weimer says in some cases, jobs in rural parts of the state have come here.
What we're looking at is how to best effectively make government work for the people. And if there are positions that haven't been filled or positions that we don't, are duplication in service or an overlap in service, and it can be better served by running it more efficiently, then let's run it more efficiently.
But it isn't attempts to be more efficient that the Assembly is worried about. Assemblymember John Davies says the Assembly's concerned that changes may look good on paper, but won't actually save money in the long run. And they want the governor to know that they're watching.
When decisions get made, when it gets beyond the rumor statement, that is, when it becomes official, you know, kind of an official policy, then it's almost too late to do anything about it. So what we're trying to do with this resolution is to kind of take a shot across the administration's bow and say, look, we're paying attention to what's going on here, and we hope that you'll think twice about this as you go down this road of making these decisions.
The resolution asks the governor and his commissioners to carefully consider and examine any personnel actions to make sure they don't adversely affect the mission of the department and that they will actually accomplish the goal on which the governor campaigned. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Fahrenkamp was diagnosed with bone cancer last winter. She missed most of this year's legislative session because of the cancer, but she represented Fairbanks and the Interior since 1978, and fellow lawmakers won't soon forget her. She was known as an avid golfer and card player and could frequently be seen in the Capitol's legislative lounge playing cribbage, but Senator Jay Curtula of Palmer says she was hard-working and driven and one of the most independent people he's known.
She had a business orientation, a development orientation, but also interwoven in that fine mental fabric was the concern for people, humanities, certainly for the liberating arts and for kids and schools, and she had it all pretty much together intellectually.
Fahrenkamp was born in Tennessee and moved to Alaska in 1956. She was a teacher before turning to politics, working as a Democratic National Committee woman in the 1970s and a special assistant to U.S. Senator Mike Gravel. Her office served as a training ground. Senator Pat Porchot of Anchorage and Representatives Tom Moyer and Mark Boyer of Fairbanks all were former Fahrenkamp aides. Boyer says that's where he learned about Alaska politics.
Betty kind of picked me up and dusted me off when I was a real young kid and introduced me to politics and taught me many, many lessons. And everything I learned about Fairbanks, I learned kind of at Betty's lap. She pushed you through the tough knocks of political life in Alaska.
Fairbanks' other state senator, Steve Frank, is a Republican, but Frank says that didn't make a difference to Fahrenkamp when it came to working together for Fairbanks.
Betty was a unique individual. She was a hardworking, effective legislator, one that had the respect of both the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats alike, and she will miss her.
A longtime Senate colleague of Fahrenkamp's was Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill. His office issued a statement expressing deep regret over Fahrenkamp's death. Coghill says, though they didn't always agree on every issue, Fahrenkamp was a friend and a respected member of the state Senate. He says replacing her will be a difficult task. Before she died, Fahrenkamp made it known that she wants her longtime friend Shirley Craft appointed to her seat. Mark Boyer says he's talking to the governor's office about that now. Hickel must appoint a Democrat to Fahrenkamp's Senate seat, and Boyer says just last Thursday she asked him again to push for Shirley Craft to get the job.
Betty's hope was to keep from having a major political fight over the replacement, and she and Shirley have known one another for over 30 years. They're philosophically very similar on the issues. Betty's colleagues in the Senate are familiar with Shirley. Shirley's traveled with Betty to Juneau for the last 4 or 5 years, and so it would be a very easy transition.
Fahrenkamp is survived by 3 stepchildren and several step-grandchildren. Her second husband, Gibb Fahrenkamp, died in 1974. The governor has ordered state flags to be flown at half-staff until Sunday in memory of Betty Fahrenkamp. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Globally, the green movement is based on ecological wisdom, social justice, grassroots democracy, and nonviolence. The chairman of the Tanana Yukon Caucus of the Greens is John Adams. Adams says the party here has the same goals as the Greens nationally, a desire for a more humane, ecologically wise, and just society.
The Green Party is not just an environmental party. The name obviously implies concern for the environment, but the concerns of the Green Party and of the Green Movement embrace the entire spectrum of current social and political issues. We're very much concerned with social justice, with economic development that is sustainable over the long haul, and many other issues of civil rights and human rights and civil liberties.
The Green Party of Alaska has already taken stands on controversial issues here. It opposes the opening of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, promotes health care for all Alaskans, and wants to recognize rights of subsistence users. Adams says taking those stands is part of the Greens' role, since the party wants to offer an alternative to politics as usual.
We are fond of saying that the Greens are neither left nor right, but out in front. And I think there's a growing number of people, certainly in Alaska and nationwide, who feel that the old political parties and the political spectrum, as it's been traditionally defined for the last 100 years or so, are really tired and in need of some new thought and some new energy. And that's what the Green Party is all about.
Adams says one of the fundamental values of the Greens is grassroots democracy. Greens think they can affect change on the global level by working at a local level. There aren't any Greens running for local offices here, but Adams says his caucus will be keeping an eye on what's going on.
But we are looking seriously at the local races and are, in fact, going to add our candidate's questionnaire to the pile from all the different groups around town, evaluate the responses that we get from local candidates, and perhaps make endorsements in this campaign. But we're just getting started. We are looking to running candidates at the local level for the state legislature, and I'm sure that the Green Party of Alaska will be running a candidate for governor next time around as well.
The Green Party caucus for the Interior Region is one of six in the state. Others are in Homer, Cordova, Juneau, Talkeetna, and Anchorage. In September, all the regional caucuses will get together in Homer for a state convention. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
And I'm going to continue pressing it until we get some answers and some explanations. But again, I do not believe that this assembly should have been held up to the ridicule that they were for following legal advice from a very high-paid attorney in this borough that is supposed to be our legal leader. And I have a
strategy or anything like that. So I think that we made a mistake and we should learn from that mistake. Having said that, however, I think that I agree with the comments previous that the light in which this thing was put, I think were hysterical and over.
Three, two, one. School officials are expecting almost 15,300 students before the year is out. On Tuesday, 14,440 students were enrolled in borough schools. Director of Planning Nick Stayrook says that number should climb in the days ahead.
Normally speaking, on the first day of school, we usually have about 92-93% of our total enrollment. So when we look at a number 14,440, it sounds like, gee, you have a ways to go yet. But usually over the next 5 or 6 days, we will get up to about 99.9% of what our enrollment is.
And as the students continue to come in, Stayrook says school principals will monitor class sizes and see if the numbers get too high. But for now, there don't appear to be any problems. That's quite a change from the last 2 years when the district ended up with a lot more students than they were expecting. Stayrook says that shouldn't be the case this year.
We were a little bit off over the last couple of years, a little bit off meaning about 500 or 600 students. Part of that was due to the Light Infantry Division, part of it to the civilian buildup as a result of the Light Infantry Division. This year there is no major buildup that we know of. The Light Infantry has been done now for a couple of years. There's no major civilian buildup that we can see. When we looked at our projections, and you have to understand, we created this year's projections last November. So it's quite a feat to project a year ahead in Fairbanks to find out what's going on here. We expect to be within about 0.5% or less of what our actual enrollment will be in October. For the last couple of years, we have only been within 2 or 3%, which is not real good when you're considering 14,000 to 15,000 students.
The official enrollment count will be taken over 20 days in October. The district will average the attendance over that time period and submit that number to the state for state reimbursement. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. It could be another 5 years before the borough needs another landfill, but borough officials have already chosen five possible locations for the new dump. FPE Rowan Engineers was hired to evaluate those sites. Project engineer Keith Hanneman has been doing that work.
About a month ago, we started evaluating the sites that the borough gave us by gathering information from maps and talking to people that are experts in the different areas and evaluating the criteria that had been established last year.
That criteria includes things like location, accessibility, the land's mineral value, wetlands and permafrost problems, and many other factors, including its life expectancy as a landfill. One of the five locations being considered is right next to the South Cushman Street landfill on its east side. Another location is on the north side of the Richardson Highway, about halfway between Fairbanks and North Pole. Property on the east side of Fort Wainwright, just north of the Chena River, is also on the list. Hanneman says those are lowland areas. The two highland areas being explored are at Big El Dorado Creek, south of Old Murphy Dome Road and east of the pipeline crossover, and an Ohio Creek site, 24 miles out of town on the park's highway. Hanneman says the details of the site's qualities are in the report, scheduled to be delivered to borough officials today. The borough already ranked the criteria in order of importance. Those rankings will now be used with the evaluations to give each site a score. And the scores will determine the three best choices. Hanneman says that's what they'll be giving the borough today.
They'll review it, and then we'll take, if they accept our recommendations, we'll take the three sites and hold public hearings on them and see what the public has to say.
A final recommendation on the best site is scheduled to be made by November 1st. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.